the name of this place.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Sonia Hilgren. I am Vice President of the National Press Club and Washington Editor of Farm Journal. I'd like to welcome club members and their guests in the audience today, as well as those of you watching on C-SPAN or listening to this program on National Public Radio or the Global Internet Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of upcoming speakers. Tomorrow, there will be a debate on the budget by Alice Rivlin, Director of the OMB, and John Kasich, Chairman of the House Budget Committee. On Friday, October 20th, Louis Rukeyser, host of Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, will reminisce about his 25 years on television in conjunction with the Press Club's annual Financial Writers Conference. On Tuesday, October 31st, the King of Norway, Harald V, will present a speech entitled Norway, a European and Atlantic Nation with a Global Outlook. Transcripts and audio and video tapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-NPC-2334. The National Press Club is also pleased to announce the publication of a new book, The National Press Club's Best Contemporary Speakers, a book containing 13 of the best speeches made during 1994. To order a copy, call 1-800-NPC-2334. If you have any questions for our speaker, please write them on the cards provided at your table, pass them up to me. I will ask as many as time permits. I'd now like to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, Nancy Waits, Reuters News Service. David Beter, Washington Bureau Chief, Omaha World Herald. Jim Poonen, Washington Bureau Chief, Kansas City Star. Richard Rominger, Deputy Secretary, U.S. Department of Agriculture. Greg Gordon, Minneapolis Star Tribune, member of the National Press Club Speakers Committee, who arranged today's luncheon. Tracy Reeves, Knight Ridder Newspapers. Jerry Hagstrom, National Journal and Agweek. Roger Runnigan, Bloomberg Business News. And Robert Green of the Associated Press. And I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Pat Nelson, Melanie Abdo-Dermont, and Howard Rothman for organizing today's luncheon. Now our guest speaker. He might really be rather singing or dancing on a stage somewhere than talking about agricultural programs to us today. For behind his image as a serious policymaker, Agriculture Secretary Dan Glickman likes to perform. It was while in college at the University of Michigan that Secretary Glickman met his wife, Rhoda Ura, who is in our audience today, whom he married in 1966. And during 18 years as a Kansas congressman, he displayed his humor in talent shows. After the House bank scandal, he appeared at the local Gridiron Club in Wichita and sang a rendition of Hey Big Spender. And when he was named chairman of the House Intelligence Committee in January 1993, he burst forth with his version of the song Secret Agent Man, except it was Secret Agent Dan. More than 6 months into his reign as Agriculture Secretary, Dan Glickman must be glad he still has a sense of humor. It might take the sting out of proposals making their way through the Republican Congress to cut the Agriculture Department's budget by $48 billion over the next 7 years. For Secretary Glickman, the reductions are serious issues. On his watch, the Republicans have voted to slash $19 billion from food stamp programs, and they are moving to scale back farm subsidies by $13.4 billion over 7 years, more than triple the cuts proposed by the Clinton administration. At the same time, House Republicans want to overhaul the 60-year-old system for awarding subsidies to the nation's farmers, a proposal that is drawing battle lines between grain and cotton farmers. President Clinton no doubt recognized when he looked for a successor for embattled Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy that Congressman Glickman could well be positioned to negotiate with the new GOP regime Secretary Glickman has developed a long-time working relationship with two key Kansas Republicans, Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole and Chairman Pat Roberts of the House Agriculture Committee. Indeed, Secretary Glickman long ago proved that he can mingle with Republicans. When he gave up his law practice and won a congressional seat in 1996, he became the first Democrat to represent the Wichita, Kansas area since 1940. He held that seat for 9 terms, during which he helped shape 4 farm bills setting the course of American agriculture over 18 years. Last November, he was among the casualties of the Republican Revolution. But now, instead of overseeing a congressional staff of 18, he finds himself in a new and tougher role as he helps shape this year's budget for an agency with more than 100,000 employees. In a climate of congressional cuts, he is seeking to preserve a safety net for American farmers, to protect gains in farmland conservation, and to avoid a severe toll on life in rural America. Through it all, he has kept smiling, tapping his experience as chairman of the Intelligence Committee. He even jokes that he has a way to protect the Agriculture Department's budget, roll it into the intelligence budget, then nobody would know how much it is. Mr. Secretary, we welcome you to center stage.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Sonia, for that interesting introduction. I'm most grateful to be here. I did have an aspiring interest in being in the entertainment business, and when I was in the Congress, we used to go down to Nashville and New York and Los Angeles at times to find out the interests of the entertainment business, and we were in Nashville at the home of Tammy Wynette, and some of my colleagues knew I liked to sing, and so they clamored for me to sing, and I got up there and sang some song, I forgot what it was, and Tammy Wynette looked absolutely astonished, horrified. And after I was done, she just told me that it was the most interesting song, but advised me to keep my day job. So that's where I am. I would, as you mentioned, our deputy from California, Rich Rominger, is here. We have several other distinguished assistant secretaries, undersecretaries, administrators, and other folks from the Department of Agriculture. I would make a note. I understand that you write your questions in, and Sonia is going to give me the questions, and I will recognize the handwriting from any of the department officials who write questions.
No, Wardell. It's not that easy. I'm not going to show you the questions.
During most of the farm bills that I have helped write, and as Sonia said, this one will be my fifth, there have always been a few critics wondering whether we might best be served by simply ending farm programs. They don't ask which programs to adopt, but whether to adopt any at all. This year, the chorus of critics seems louder. But now, instead of just asking whether to continue farm programs, some are asking whether to continue to having a farm department in the federal government at all. They clearly do not understand USDA and what it does. You can tell by the way they frame the question. We are more, much more than just a farm department. But it's not just Congress that misunderstands the USDA. We are very misunderstood by the public. The other day, one of my undersecretaries was sitting in front of the USDA building on the mall when a commercial tour mobile stopped in front. You've seen them. The first thing the tour guide told his passengers was that there were more employees in the Department of Agriculture than there were farmers in the United States. Next, he told them that the typical beneficiaries of the department are millionaires. And finally, he ended by saying that most beneficiaries were not even real farmers, and all they do is subsidize McDonald's. This is a true comment that was made on the tour mobile that one of my undersecretaries heard just last week. Well, if you believe those myths, you do not know about much what we do, what we are working on. And you surely have no reason to think that USDA is relevant for the 21st century. These myths are part of the reason I've asked Congress to change the name of the department to the Department of Food and Agriculture. That name comes closer to saying who we are and what we do. But even that name fails to account for our education and research programs, our community development efforts, conservation programs, and responsibility for natural resources. There are more researchers and scientists at USDA who have been recognized and won awards for their work than at any other federal agency. We sponsor one of the world's largest and most effective education networks and an extension system used as a model in dozens of countries. You would probably suspect that we are the leaders in genetics research. Much of what we've done in the plant and animal area has worked its way into the medical area. But you may not also know that it was the United States Department of Agriculture that used the discovery of penicillin and made it into a commercially viable medicine. A few weeks ago, 60 Minutes featured a report on the Colonias, the settlements along the U.S.-Mexican border. What they did not report, however, is that USDA has been spearheading an effort to remedy the outrageous health and sanitation problems in those areas. The Colonias is a priority for our community development programs, and we are funding efforts to replace sewer and water systems, which are either non-existent or don't work at all. As for natural resources, we have more people working with private, state, and local landowners and investing more federal dollars than any other federal agency to conserve soil, water, and forests. Our programs cover more land and have made a greater contribution to protecting the environment than those in any other part of the executive branch. And we need to fulfill our pledge to provide a steady supply of timber in an environmentally sound manner. Many of you may know that the Forest Service is the largest employer in the Department of Agriculture, employs nearly 50,000 people, and does an excellent job in dealing with the resources of timber. If there is any one great success story at USDA since the 1930s, it is this in the soil and water conservation efforts that have saved billions of tons of soil and kept the water safe and clean for millions of Americans. By the way, these programs are in great jeopardy in the Republican Revolution, and their destruction will do more harm to American agriculture and American rural infrastructure than we can ever imagine. The administration's 1995 Farm Bill conservation proposals have focused on common sense conservation. A healthy land, high quality soil, water, plants, and air is requisite for a productive, profitable agriculture. Unless you cover USDA day in and day out, you probably were not aware of these programs. They are real accomplishments that I'm proud of. And they not only make USDA relevant to the 21st century, they make it absolutely essential. I consider one of my critical tasks as secretary to redefine the department's image, and I can tell you it will not be easy. There are, of course, the institutional hurdles in any bureaucracy that any secretary faces, and there are many voices raised for the status quo in agricultural policy. I recall the old senator who was retiring, and his young assistant says, "Well, Senator, you must have seen a lot of changes in your tenure in the Senate over these years." And the senator says, "Yes, son, I have, and I've been against every damned one of them." But more important, I think, are the constraints of traditional ways of thinking about the department and its role. Those constraints are clear in the current debate on the 1995 Farm Bill. As Congress considers how best to reduce spending on farm programs, few have considered the real message, and thus the real imperative for future agricultural policy. As spending on traditional commodity programs decline, as it will under the Farm Bill written this year and as it did under the 1990 Farm Bill, these programs will gradually become less important. It's time for the agriculture community to change its focus, to recognize this fundamental transformation in farm policy. It's time we stop focusing our exclusive attention on what the target price for wheat or cotton will be. In the 21st century, support prices will be less relevant in ensuring that American agriculture remains competitive and able to exploit the coming revolution in the world agriculture markets. Research, trade policy, conservation, and food safety will come to dominate agriculture policy. Now, commodity programs, corn, rice, wheat, and cotton, and oilseeds, they will continue to be critical, but they must be geared to the future of American agriculture. They must enable farmers to respond to the market, not straitjacket production. That is why the administration proposed full planting flexibility in our Farm Bill proposal, a plan that was the first to promote what has now become a central plank of all the competing Farm Bill plans. While it is time to break some of the historic bonds of farm programs, it is important to maintain one of their most important features, to serve as a safety net for food production. We have maintained that elemental feature. When times are tough, when prices are low, when farmers have to bear the most risk under our plan, government will continue to shoulder part of that risk. And we believe that the budget of the congressional leadership directly challenged the ability for us to shoulder part of that risk. But we also believe that payments should be targeted to family-size operations. There is no reason that a government with limited financial resources should continue to subsidize the largest producers. We propose to continue supplementing farm income through a counter-cyclical program of income price supports. We will help when times are tough, but we will not turn a shortfall into a windfall as some alternative proposals do. We also believe that we should not abandon our farmers when other foreign governments continue to use trade-distorting policies, insulate their farmers and their producers from the world markets. The European Union continues to spend more than 7 times the amount we do on farm programs. That is, with a population about 10% greater than ours, 15% greater than ours, they spend 7 times on agriculture than we do in this country. So this administration will not unilaterally disarm in the face of that kind of spending. We do not know what the future holds in agriculture. And quite honestly, we have very little understanding of what these proposals mean, the proposals that are being proposed in Congress for farmers, consumers, conservation, trade, the concerns we normally analyze before enacting a farm bill. Of the curious things about this year's farm bill debate, few are more striking than the lack of public hearings about the major legislative proposals. There have been some hearings on both sides, and I've testified on some of these hearings. But there have been no hearings on what we are seeing emerging from both committees. There has always been plenty of criticism about farm bill processes in the past. But one criticism was never leveled. The process never suffered from lack of public debate, hearings, and open bill writing sessions. I have had farmers ask me about these bills. What do they mean to them? And even more basic questions like whether they propose ending farm programs altogether. My own analysts have asked the same things. No one knows, or at least no one has said so publicly. There are simply still too many questions about a proposal that spends over $40 billion, lasts for 7 years, and sets policy for such a critical sector of the economy. So I have decided to hold my own public forums on the farm bill. First of all, I need some basic answers to questions we have about the proposals. Second, I have the responsibility to make sure that the American agriculture and all of its parts have the information needed to make an informed decision about whether to support the proposals. Let me be clear. These will be nonpartisan forums. I intend to ask supporters and detractors, sponsors and cynics alike to provide their comments. A series of 3 sessions will be held in our headquarters, concentrating on commodity programs and research, conservation, and block granting of rural development and related proposals. I believe there is a lack of answers about what could be fairly major rewrites of existing programs, and I want to resolve as many questions as possible. We hope to conduct the forums during the week of October 30th. For the long range, we must make sure that agriculture policy, not just the Department of Agriculture, is relevant. That is what really matters. To accomplish that, let me return to a point I made a little bit earlier. The traditional importance of commodity programs, programs that transfer income from non-farmers to farmers, is decreasing. Now, some will brand that as heresy, and me, a Secretary of Agriculture, a heretic, for acknowledging this readily apparent and compelling trend. Contrary to popular myth about the department, the vast majority of American farmers receive no direct income assistance from the government. About one-third receive that form of help. Quite frankly, I think it would be derelict in my duty in not facing up to this fact, and while protecting the basic safety net, in turning policy directions to other areas, and that is what we have been doing. While the headline writers have been mesmerized by the partisan budget battles and the ups and downs of unpaid acreage requirements of the farm budget arguments, we have been toiling away at some of the areas that I think hold the key to making USDA and American agriculture relevant to the future, to people all over this country. And we've had some major successes. Last summer, the Senate Ag Committee wrote the trade, credit, rural development, and research titles of the Farm Bill and adopted virtually all of what we had recommended to Congress. The Senate adopted our proposals to make our trade programs more flexible and responsive to growing markets. We wanted to consolidate programs and ensure that we could use them to target emerging markets. The committee has agreed. There is no question in my mind that trade and exports are the future of American agriculture. I think we are seeing a fundamental transformation of world grain markets from one of surplus to one of demand. We no longer live with the myth that USDA hoards huge surpluses of grain. We no longer even have surplus dairy products. Recent bullish prices of wheat, corn, soybeans, and cotton have largely occurred because of increased economic and population growth in the developing world. These trends will have enormous ramifications on American agriculture and are likely to reach far beyond that to raise serious and profound geopolitical questions. If you want to see the face of the future of American national security concerns, look into the eyes of the Chinese mother wondering how to get her child's next meal. With that responsibility comes opportunity, and what we have recommended and had approved will, I am confident, ensure our relevance in these markets. We are already setting records with our exports. Those exports now come close to equaling our budget, a target I predict we will reach by the dawn of the 21st century of at least $65 billion. If we are to stay competitive and to keep those exports going, we have to make sure that we keep the advantage that got us there, our research, our technical advances, and our ability to apply amazing technology. That is why we've asked the Congress for authorization to better target our agricultural research needs. Too many research dollars are spent in the same way as they were three decades ago. The world has changed so much our research priorities. And I am pleased that the Senate committee has accepted some of those proposals as well as what we have proposed to improve the delivery of rural development programs. We think this proposal, patterned on our Rural Partnership Performance Initiative, will empower local officials while improving the performance of our federal delivery system. These are a few of the significant examples, and there are many, many others going on in the Farm Bill debate that I am confident are vital to the future of American agriculture. We are making a difference not only in recommending and getting adopted future policies, we are making a difference today in other areas. The school lunch program is perhaps one of the department's proudest accomplishments and one that is also being challenged by many in the congressional leadership. Not only does the lunch program represent the best in government, making sure that basic human needs are met, it symbolizes the synthesis that is in the Department of Agriculture. That program was born out of concern about some of the consequences of farm abundance and developed into a symbiotic partnership between farmers and food interests that has probably accomplished more in recent years than any other political alliance. We have just updated nutrition standards and streamlined program administration in the school lunch program for the first time in 50 years. We are in the midst of the first fundamental modernization of our nation's meat safety system since Upton Sinclair wrote his expose of the system, The Jungle, at the turn of the century. While we have the safest food supply in human history, let there be no mistake that it is woefully outdated. We are going to bring modern technology and sound science into the nation's food processing plants. The public demands nothing less, and we intend to deliver nothing less. Like feeding the hungry, food safety is an example for all the government that wants to be relevant in the 21st century. The purpose of government has not changed since Abraham Lincoln, who founded this department, defined it. And he said, and I quote, "The legitimate object of government is to do for a community of people whatever they need to have done but cannot do it all or cannot do so well for themselves. I intend to move the department towards that purpose." The mood of the country and Congress is changing as we repeal many of the old laws and rules for regulating the market. Many of those steps are long overdue, and I support them. However, some may have side effects that need further study. And one of the most glaring, and one I want to spend a little bit of time on this afternoon, is in the area of decreasing competition in the marketplace. I will act to stop this lack of competition, over-concentration, where it affects agriculture. But I'm concerned about it wherever I see it. There scarcely seems to be a week that goes by without another major media merger in the marketplace. We are nearly to the point when a handful of companies will control what we see on the screen, whether in the theaters or in our homes, and every form of entertainment. We are down to only four nationwide airlines. Two railroads carry virtually all the grain and other products that move west of the Mississippi River. In many rural parts of the country, the only bank that is left is a branch of a national chain. It is time to act. Why is this lack of competition or over-concentration harmful? Because it results in less choice, lower quality, and higher prices. Every consumer is potentially hurt. We have to move aggressively, or we may find that very soon we cannot effectively address these trends to greater and greater concentration, which means fewer and fewer choices in the marketplace for consumers and producers. Perhaps the single issue I've heard about while traveling the country the last several months has been concern about concentration in the meat processing industry. Today, four companies control nearly 90% of the industry. Actually, three control in excess of 80% of the industry. Four companies control this country's supply of meat. I think it is much different than having four companies controlling our domestic production of cars. In many parts of this country, a cattle, hog, or chicken producer may be locked into one market for his product without any competitive choice. We will have a study out later this year on concentration in the meat processing industry, but that is not enough. We must and will enforce vigorously the anti-concentration law on the books in our jurisdiction, the Packers and Stockyards Act, that sets out some antitrust-like prohibitions. I intend to do that, and if necessary, I will ask Congress for more changes in the law. For example, we have already filed an action against the country's largest meatpacking company, seeking to get it to stop what we believe to be an anti-competitive practice in its purchasing. As I said, we need first to look at what is already on the books, but we need to do more, and we need to do it now. Accordingly, I support legislation introduced this morning by Senator Daschle and others to establish a commission on concentration in the meatpacking industry. I will move ahead to initiate the work necessary to look more closely at what tools we have, those we need, and what steps can be taken immediately to address this problem. Again, I want to emphasize that our concerns have to be more than worrying about the efficiency of a market. A monopoly can be very efficient, but offer few avenues for price competition. And farmers and ranchers and consumers demand that these choices be available to them. After nearly two decades in public life, I have also learned that being effective is more than just implementing programs and passing laws. They are important, and I think the department has achieved a lot in the last few months. Being effective in public life also means persuasion and using the pulpit of public office to bring people together to accomplish goals and to solve problems. I mentioned the Farm Food Coalition earlier. That is an example. Here is another example. I have long had an interest, indeed was involved in some limited ways when I was in Congress, in gleaning or in sharing food that would be wasted if not eaten. During the Jewish high holidays, I came across a passage from the book of Leviticus that has stayed with me. It reads, "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap the corners of your field, and do not glean the fallen ears of your crop. You must leave them for the poor and the stranger." The amount of food, fresh and prepared, that is wasted in this country is shocking and should be to you as well. Nearly one-fifth of all the food produced for human consumption in this country is lost every year. Almost 49 million people could have been fed if that food had been recovered. Hundreds, thousands of tons of food is thrown away every day in restaurants, cafeterias, schools, and hospitals. Tens of thousands of pieces of fried chicken are thrown away every day from restaurants in this country, for one example. I am proud that the department is starting to do something about this problem. Each Friday, about 150 pounds of food from our cafeteria goes to the D.C. Central Kitchen. 250 people get meals. Small drop in the bucket, but it's a start, and a lot more can be done. Next month, I will host a conference before Thanksgiving on gleaning and food sharing in America. This is one of my highest personal priorities as Secretary. I want to bring together different levels of government, businesses, workers, and the nonprofit community to see how we can solve some of our nation's hunger problems through gleaning, through the sharing of food that would otherwise be wasted or thrown away. While we strongly support adequate funding for the food stamp program, we also recognize that creating public-private sector partnerships can be a significant force in reducing hunger. I not only want to solve a real pressing human and social problem, I want to use this conference as a model for the role of the department in the future. As I said earlier, to be relevant in the 21st century, we need to perform the role individuals cannot perform themselves. We need to take the risks individuals cannot take themselves, and we need to bring individuals together when they can't do it themselves. Let me close with a story about people with long spoons. Two people were walking around a house of obviously very poor people. In one room, there were a lot of people sitting around a round table like this with a pot of soup in the middle, and each one had a spoon of about 10 feet long. And these people were in agony. And they were clearly starving to death and extremely unhappy. And in the second room, the people were sitting around a long table with the very same very long spoons. But the soup bowl was empty, and the people looked happy and well-fed. And one gentleman who was accompanying the other gentleman says, "I don't understand that. In the one room, people couldn't seem to feed themselves and were starving to death. In the other room, everybody seemed very happy. What's the difference?" And the tour guide says, "Well, the difference is, in the second room, they have learned to feed each other." More than any other department in government, that story is relevant to USDA. Whether in farm, rural development, research, conservation, nutrition, or food safety, the goal should be a healthy combination of self-help and self-reliance, personal responsibility, and where needed and appropriate, a national effort to help people doing a better job of helping themselves. Thank you very much.
There are the farm legislation. The House version has 7-year contracts with farmers for definite pre-known amounts of money. It limits the amount very strongly about payments that can be made to farmers. The Senate bill continues what we have, but has non-pay acres increased to 30%. Still has bigger payments for farmers. Which of these two do you prefer?
Well, neither. We think the both bills are predicated on very large cuts, larger than we think are necessary and larger than we think a lot of mid-sized farmers can survive. There are things we like about both bills, quite frankly. The Roberts proposal has full flexibility. We like that. We think farmers ought to plant for what the market tells them to plant. On the other hand, we think the guaranteed payment for farmers under the Roberts bill is inappropriate and will reward people during good economic times, which we don't think the taxpayers will support. The Senate bill is obviously more like current law and more like some of the proposals we've talked about, but it is complicated and would be very difficult to implement in a simple way. So we hope to be an active player in working and helping synthesize the best of those bills, but doing it with some new ideas and also with far less stringent budget cutting.
How can you be an active player when the Congress has actually approved $13.4 billion cuts? Does this mean that in a reconciliation bill down the road that the administration insists on more money for farm programs?
We don't know what it's going to be in a reconciliation bill. It will be many things beyond agriculture. But all I can tell you is that the administration is not keen on the budget cuts nor the specific proposals to implement those budget cuts in agriculture, and certainly not in Medicare and Medicaid and other areas. I'm not going to threaten any kind of veto because that's above my pay grade, and I'm not in a position to do it, nor do I know whether there would be one. But I can't imagine that if everything that is in there stays in there, that the president would feel very comfortable swallowing it. So we don't know where this process is going to end up, whether there'll be vetoes or not vetoes, but I suspect that since the President of the United States has to sign a bill that there will be efforts to try to reconcile and improve some of these provisions, including the farm provisions. We hope so, at least.
Do you fear that agriculture may be overshadowed by the fights over Medicare, Medicaid, tax cuts? What sort of message has been sent to President Clinton on opposing the reconciliation package because of harm to the agricultural community?
Well, first place, a lot of the provisions are a dagger at rural America, not just the farm provisions, but the health care provisions, Medicare and Medicaid. That affects rural America in a disproportionate negative way, over and above even the farm program cuts. The farm cuts will hurt some farmers more than other farmers, depending upon where you are in the country. So I think from a rural perspective, the president is concerned about the whole kit and caboodle.
Does your criticism of Republican farm proposals and your plan for hearings the week of October 30th ring hollow when you and the administration refused to offer a specific farm bill?
We have offered a specific farm bill. It's in our blue book, and we offered ways to meet the $4 to $4.5 billion program cuts. I did that myself before the Senate Ag Committee, to the amazement of Senator Kerry and others who didn't think that we'd do that. We said you could meet the cuts through some increase in unpaid acres and some better targeting, limiting program payments to farmers who had off-farm net incomes of less than $100,000. The Congress did not agree with those things. So we have proposed specific program cuts. It's just that we think that their proposals are excessive in terms of the amount of cuts.
You mentioned that the question of a veto is above your pay grade, but would you recommend a veto of either farm proposal or possibly the Freedom to Farm Act?
Well, look, I've spent 18 years in the legislative process, and I think one of the reasons the president picked me was because not only did he know that I had good relationships with Pat Roberts and Bob Dole, but my style was to try to be not excessively controversial and partisan. Farmers and ranchers in this country and consumers don't want an ag secretary out there recommending or talking about vetoes all the time, and I'm not going to do it. I do think that there are some bottom lines, I think the president has spoken to those bottom lines, and I think a reconciliation package that's a direct dagger at the heart of rural America would be virtually impossible for the president to support. But in terms of specific vetoes, I think we ought to stay away from that right now.
In view of very tight world food supplies that you referred to, should we continue to have 36 million acres in the conservation when many of these acres are subject to conservation compliance if they were taken out?
Let me offer a couple comments here, and this may be a long. Number one is we're obviously entering a different age in agriculture. I don't know if it's the golden age, but I hope so. And I would have to note that the price bullishness began about the day after I became secretary, just so everybody here knows that. But the fact is that we are clearly at this crossroads in world agriculture policy, and you can just see what's happening, the confluence of economic growth and population growth and Far East and other parts of the world are happening. It's been happening for some time, and bad weather obviously has been a factor in this, but we're in for a longer period of time of greater bullishness on particularly the grains, and hopefully it will extend to livestock as well and fresh fruits and vegetables and other commodities. So it means we have to look at our farm programs in the context of this changing world. Now, let me go back to the Conservation Reserve Program for a moment. I'm sure that not every acre of land that's in there ought to be in there. And my guess is that when we're through with this farm bill process, we may scale it back some, but it is a very important program, and it is one that will provide a long-term protection of land, particularly at a time when there are higher prices, and the effort will be is to get it all back into production, and we want to try to resist that. The other thing I would tell you is that the great strength of American agriculture since the 1930s have been in our conservation programs. We have saved billions of tons of soil and protected extraordinary amounts of water from being polluted. It is probably what affects most Americans more than anything else, these proposals on conservation in water and soil area. And I fear that if we don't keep a vigilant effort on the conservation side of the picture, we will lose it at a time of great budget cuts, great ideology about the role of government, and also higher prices, which will encourage farmers perhaps to plant more than maybe what is in the best interest of our children and grandchildren. So I personally view this issue, the conservation issue, to be the linchpin upon which all other farm programs ought to be built. Now, that doesn't mean that we're foolish in how we do them. It doesn't mean we use a hammer and hit people over the head, because that's not my style. And it does mean, however, that in an incentive-based, cooperative-based way, we recognize that 10 generations from now, they will not know what the target price of wheat will be. But they will know if we still have tillable soil in which to plant crops.
They'll also know if we have clean streams, rivers, and lakes. Are we mitigation money in the proper way by keeping out of production some land that is not erodible, spending enough for water quality, for livestock waste systems?
Well, our conservation chiefs are here, and they I'm sure can speak afterwards better than I, but I think that we are in fact trying to modernize our programs in terms of a variety of private-public sector partnerships and conservation practices that would be involved with the whole farm efforts and would deal with livestock issues as well. So the answer is, yes, we need to modernize those programs. Now, one thing I've said to my friend Pat Roberts, to be honest with you, is I think we need more money in this area. I said, you want to take this extra money and freedom to farm and just provide the payments even when times are good. I said, maybe when times are good, we ought to protect the money. He wants to protect the baseline, and I think that's a good idea. But let's protect the money and not necessarily send it out to producers when times are good. Maybe we use it to enhance conservation practices or increase and modernize our research better or use the money to protect the baseline but do it in a long-term investment sense.
Well, in the short term, I understand that some farmers haven't been getting some payments for their conservation reserve programs, little disagreement between you and the Congress. Now, Senator Dole wrote to you and said that you have the ability to send these payments out. Is this going to be resolved? The President going to sign the Ag Appropriations Bill?
Funny how some of you got that letter before I did. Anyway, I never did that when I was in Congress, so I assure you. The fact is that we have passed the Agriculture Appropriations Bill in the House and the Senate. And while the President has not authorized me to say that he will sign it, I have not heard a lot of evidence coming out of the White House that it's going to be vetoed. Once that bill gets signed, these payments go ahead. Absolutely. And it's passed both houses. I believe that bill is being held at the Speaker's desk, perhaps as part of some grand budget strategy. So it's within the power of the Congress to send the bill to the President. We'll get this issue resolved. I would say that there is some discussion as to whether we can make these CRP payments since we're in a continuing resolution. I think the lawyers disagree a bit, but as I understand it, there is some belief that we could make a pro rata payment because the continuing resolution expires on November 13th, so we could make a 43-day CRP payment, and that's it. And I would say that probably would end up costing the government a lot more money and bureaucracy involved. Why don't they just get this bill to the President? That would be the easiest way to handle it.
I sort of don't get it. I mean, Senator Dole says, considering the fact that CRP payments have been made previously using continuing resolution authority, this is an obligation of farmers that U.S.
All I can tell you is that I believe strongly the payments ought to be made, but we are advised that if we make the payments, we have to do it on a pro rata basis. But look, I seem to recall when the shoe was on the other foot, there was a lot of serious concern by the Republicans in Congress to seeing the government spend money during the time of a continuing resolution in which the government wasn't funded for the year. I'm saying the bills have been passed. They've held at the Speaker's desk. This is not a way to run a railroad. Send the bill to the President.
I remember in your confirmation hearings before the Senate Agriculture Committee that you expressed some degree of lack of knowledge of dairy. You said you were going to learn more. So the farm programs or the farm bills have focused so much on crops, but dairy would also face, first of all, freedom to milk, just making payments farmers. How do you feel about that? And what about Mr. Gunn's proposal to deregulate the milk marketing order system?
We are not in favor of either proposal. Deregulating the milk system would prejudice people in a lot of areas of this country, and there would be a reduction in net farm income by an awful lot of producers, either under the House bill or under the Senate bill. What we do favor is drastically reducing the amount and number of milk marketing orders, making them much more flexible in terms of operating them. Right now, it takes 50 years to get a change in the order almost just because of the nature of the administrative process, and we got to clean that up, and we've proposed that. And I do think that there is a reason to look at the whole issue of price differentials because some parts of the country are prejudiced. But I believe, with all respect to Steve Gunderson, who I consider a very fine member of Congress, that his proposal would cause a reduction in farm income in various parts of this country. And the other thing I would say is, the dairy program costs the government virtually no money anymore. During the 1980s, the dairy program was rather expensive, in excess of $2 billion one year. The dairy program costs probably about 5% of that right now, or maybe it's almost a no-net cost program. So it is not a major reason why we have a budget deficit.
The Department of Interior is about to make final a rule that would exempt landowners with 5 acres or less from habitat protection requirements under endangered species. This won't help farmers and ranchers at all. What are you going to do?
Well, I don't know what I'm going to do about it. I think that the Department of Interior is moving ahead to try to ease implementation and compliance with the Endangered Species Act. We're working with them on that, trying to get some cooperation in making that law more practical. But we still have a very strong commitment to the basic purposes of the Act. But I do think there is the recognition that Departments of Agriculture and Interior working together need to promote an area of more conciliation on some of these environmental issues, and we are, in fact, doing that.
The Clinton administration worked out a deal to try and do some of the overlap in wetland programs. And yet now, in effect, even though the Ag Department was supposed to have a final say on wetlands, the Interior Department's Fish and Wildlife Service seems to have veto power on these things. Should that be changed?
Well, in the first place, some of you may know one of the first things I did when I became secretary was to stop the delineation of wetlands under those programs within our jurisdiction, and that is still undergoing. So we're working with Fish and Wildlife, but we recognize that farmers and ranchers do need certainty when it comes to this issue of wetlands delineation. And we are going to continue to be an active voice in that process.
Congress was recently very angry over Undersecretary Jim Lyons' handling of forest policies, and that is the amount of timber that should be cut. Now, you've assured the Congress he'll enforce the law, and as a matter of fact, you talked the Congress out of eliminating his job, and I understand that a judge has kept him out of jail in a lawsuit against him. Would you explain this further, and is Mr. Lyons' future secure?
Well, actually, he's here today. Maybe he should answer that question. It was either him or me in jail, and as far as I'm concerned, I'm not going. So, his position secure. It's a very complicated area, forest policy, timber policy. It involves very strong feelings between people who, frankly, don't want to see any trees cut at all and those who want to see an excessive amount of trees cut. And the administration, and we believe that a sensible way of preserving both timber jobs as well as effective conservation schemes believe that the answer lies somewhere in the middle, and we are working that through. And usually when you're in the middle, you make both sides unhappy, and that is what is happening. And but I had many conversations with many fine United States senators and congressmen to tell them what a fine man Jim Lyons is, and I think they now believe that.
Is the department planning a response to the enormous rail pending between Union Pacific and Southern Pacific, which would create a duopoly with Burlington Santa Fe and reduce competitive choice for farmers?
I believe that we have provided written comments to the ICC on that particular merger, and I don't want to comment further because I'm not exactly sure about administration policy specifically on this particular merger. I did point out that in vast sections of the West, you will end up with far less competition in moving grain than you have right now, and that is a matter of serious concern to the department.
Given the push on meat packer concentration and your comments to that effect, would you comment on the recent purchase of John Morrell by Smithfield Foods?
No.
Boy, that's unusual. Never heard this man answer with a one-word answer. China is really an amazing market with great potential, and purchases are one of the in connection with our crop that we have tight food supplies. What is your view of the future of for American agriculture?
It's very good. I'm not a Pollyanna, however. We saw in the 1970s we thought the Russians would become the market of the history of the world. I see my friend from Russia there, and it didn't pan out, and a lot of people thought it was going to, and the fact of the matter is we need to be a lot more circumspect that any one market will dominate this country, this country's sales. But I would have to tell you that you do not have to be a rocket scientist to look at China and see that if they want to preserve their economic growth and keep a growing middle class and keep their people fed, they're going to have to import a lot of food. And not only China, but all of East Asia and India as well. And the markets have a spectacular potential, as long as we're sensible about that. And that's one of the reasons why I talk about this golden age of agriculture. I do believe the next decade or two in American agriculture are going to be so much different than the last four or five decades. Since I've been in Congress, every time I talk to a farmer, it always relates to low prices and what are you going to do to control supply. That's the heart of the farm debate. That debate is changing. That era is probably over. Now, saying that, I think that there are going to be ups and downs in this. But the era of the future is going to be a lot more sophisticated, and it's going to require us to be aggressive players in world markets, because I want to tell you something. Every exporting country in the world thinks that China is their market, and we have to make sure that they know that there is no one market that belongs to any other country in the world. We're going to actively fight for those markets. And my own belief is that aggressively pursuing China sales as well as other part of the country, we will see continued success for American farmers. I hope to go to China early next year. Rich Rominger was just there. I met the Chinese ag minister in Quebec City this past weekend. And I have a feeling that there will be a lot of positive news over the next few years with respect to U.S. Sales of agriculture commodities, and not just grains, soybeans, meats, fresh fruits and vegetables. What we have to prevent the Chinese from doing, however, and what they've begun to do, is to get into a trade protection game. There are too many bad actors in this world, that bad teachers that they are following in terms of keeping products out of their markets, using bad science for sanitary and phytosanitary methods. And Gus Schumacher and others in the Department of Agriculture are working their best to make sure that the Chinese markets are open, and that if China wants a place at the table in the world trading markets, then they have to play by rules which allow free markets and fair markets to operate. And I think they will. And I'm not saying this in a threatening way. I just think we need to make our position very clear. And I think if that's so, then the U.S. and China can be very significant trading partners in the years to come.
You talked about some Chinese policies that sometimes are to do with the Europeans, and Deputy Secretary Rominger is headed to Europe this afternoon. Can you comment on some of our conks with beef hormones, genetically beans, and their exports, wheat gluten?
I think I just commented generally by saying that using bad science as a non-tariff trade barrier is one of the worst things that we can see in this modern post-GATT world, and I'm going to fight it like crazy. And whether it is in the hormone issue or the genetically modified soybean issue or anything else in the world, we can't let culture and bad taste dominate barriers between countries. And so that's just an issue I know Rich is going to deal with. He's going to meet with Dr. Fischler and others, talk about those things. We also have to make sure that we don't get back into this game of protection through indirect methods. More and more we see perhaps the European Union using export taxes as a way to keep grain from flowing outside their markets. And I think the United States would feel that that is not in the interests of a free and open trading system, and we would also find that very offensive.
I want to give you a mug from the National Press Club, and I'm sure you have plenty of these, but hey, it's another certificate commemorating your speech here today. And then I'd like to ask you a question.
Sure.
Is the Bob Dole that we see in here on the campaign trail the same fellow Kansan and fellow Aggie?
You expect me to answer that question. We Kansans stick together, so I'm going to say nice things about him. I think he makes an excellent Senate leader, and I hope he continues in that role for many years to come.
Are you going to run for the Senate?
I think this is a great job. Where else could you go and taste food, look at food, touch food all your life, you know, and enjoy it so much? So no, my days in the Congress were very interesting, but this job certainly is one that I want to do my best to serve the country, serve farmers and ranchers, and serve the president as well. So I am making no plans to run for the Senate or anything else.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sonia. Okay. Sure.